Welcome to the New Books Network.
Tennessee Williams wrote, "Life is partly what we make it, and partly what is made by the friends we choose." Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network, with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Please subscribe to our series on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm happy to welcome Lydia Denworth to the show today to talk about her new book, Friendship, The Evolution, Biology, and the Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. Lydia Denworth is a science writer and contributing editor for Scientific American. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and other publications. Lydia Denworth, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Renee. It's good to be here.
Before we begin, I'd like to know a little bit about yourself. Specifically, was there someone or something particularly influential in your intellectual development?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've never been asked that way before.
We aim to please.
Do I have to pick just one? There are several, but some that come to mind. So I, as a child, I always was interested in books and words and writing. I was a voracious reader, but I started reading The New Yorker relatively young, and I found the work of John McPhee. Who is one of our great sort of nonfiction writers in the United States. And I was so captivated by the way he could make anything interesting. So I never really aspired to write fiction. I always wanted to be a writer, and I always wanted to do nonfiction. And then later, though, when I started working for magazines, I was at Newsweek as a young researcher/reporter. And I got asked by Sharon Begley, who was a great science journalist here in the U.S., to help her on a story about physics, about quarks. And I was not a science-driven person. In fact, I had taken the minimum amount of science possible in high school and college, and yet here I am a science writer. And I think in some ways we have Sharon to thank for that. She told me then that I needed to believe in my ability to ask questions and that I was plenty smart enough to do it, and I shouldn't worry about, you know, not having a deep background in science. And I worked quite a bit with Sharon in those years. Then I moved on to do other things for a while, but I circled back mid-career and now really have found my footing writing about science, journalists like me are, one of our jobs is to translate science for a lay audience, but also to cast a critical eye on it. But I find it now deeply interesting. I can't believe I wasn't interested before. I don't know. But I'm so kind of thrilled, halfway through my adulthood that I found this place to work, and because I find it so intellectually satisfying every day.
Well, it sounds like you didn't let your schooling get in the way of your education.
That's a good way of putting it. That's right.
Well, your book is on a topic very dear to my heart, and it follows the thread of friendship from the cellular level to the animal world, mm-hmm. and on through the complex human, emotional, and social life of the 21st century. In perusing all of that, what was the most surprising thing you learned about friendship along the way?
Well, again, I have two answers, because one is just right at the beginning. The whole reason I wanted to write the book was that I just found it surprising. Friendship is something we think we know so much about, and it's so familiar in so many ways. So to discover that there was this biology to friendship and an evolutionary story there was really surprising and interesting to me. And I thought, if I didn't realize that, and here I was, someone who was covering science you know, for a living, then maybe other people didn't know that either. So I started there. But then of all of the specific things that I covered in the book, perhaps the most surprising, certainly the most kind of gee whiz cool, is the neuroscience I describe at the end of the book, where people have, the scientists have been able to see by scanning people's brains that our way of processing the world looks much more like the way our friends process the world than it does like the way people we're less close to do it. It's to the extent that if they just look at your brain processing when you're watching videos, if they just are looking at the results they're getting, they can predict who's closer to who in terms of friendship, which means that we literally see and hear the world more like our friends than like people that we're less close to. And that means that the idea that we, you know, there's all kinds of little sayings like birds of a feather flock together. And even Aristotle said that, you know, similarity is part of friendship. But I don't know that anybody imagined that it was right down to the level of the way you process the auditory and visual world. And it is.
Yes, that was an amazing thing. It was really so remarkable to read that. It's kind of a brain synchrony between friends.
Yes.
And it seems almost mystical.
Well, I loved, so Talia Wheatley is the neuroscientist at Dartmouth who was one of them who was working on that. And she has such wonderful ways of talking about it as friendship is a dance between two brains kind of coming together and making something new together. And I thought that was such a charming way to describe it and to think about it. But the big question, and it was unanswered at the time that I had to finish my reporting and write the book, was, is whether we start out more like our friends right. in our brain processing, or whether we become more like our friends over time as we get to know each other. And, you know, like a lot of things in life, the answer is probably that a little of both. And we do see some signs of synchrony increasing with exposure to other people. But yes, I agree. There is something still sort of mystical and just wonderful about it. That
yes, and the biological basis of friendship is a little easier to understand since we've all probably read the great deal of writing about loneliness lately. It's even been called an epidemic, and England and Japan have government ministers of loneliness. I'm not sure loneliness is the opposite of friendship, but it's certainly somewhere at the other side of a continuum. What does your exploration of friendship say about loneliness?
Well, it is exactly that. I do think of them as two ends of a continuum, and it's the continuum that looks at your level of social integration, basically. And so if you have, you know, strong friendships, somebody with strong friendships at one end and loneliness at the other end, we find that the physical effects of those things, either to the negative with loneliness or for the positive with friendship, are related. They're, you know, so for instance, your heart rate changes, your cardiovascular functioning changes as a result of whether you're lonely or feel socially connected, immune system changes. So you're more susceptible to viruses and inflammation if you're lonely, and you're more resilient if you feel socially connected. Your risk of dementia, your risk of mental health, your stress responses, the quality of your sleep, the rate at which your cells age, and your longevity. I mean, most people have seen that you live longer if you have more friends. it's not so much about more friends as the quality. When we're really talking about health, quality matters more than quantity, although quantity has, there are reasons why that is also a good thing. But so to me, it's the effects on our health are the kind of mirror images from friendship and loneliness.
So when you say quality of friendship, are you talking about having a confidant, or are you talking about What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, that's one of the really interesting questions here that I think that this science has helped to clarify, because defining friendship is a little bit it's a little amorphous for, right? And people have different definitions, and it's one reason why kind of serious biologists and neuroscientists weren't studying friendship for a long time, because in science, you really do need to be able to define and to measure things. You have to be able to compare measurements. But one of the things that happened is that, and I am getting to the answer here of quality, but there's a little backstory that is that, one of the ways we began to understand, so for a very, very long time, hundreds, thousands of years, we thought, we knew friendship was wonderful and pleasurable, but we thought it was primarily cultural, like a, you know, a nice byproduct of human language and civilization. And of course, there are many, many cultural layers to friendship. But understanding that it had this biology and evolutionary story actually required partly the health stuff that we just talked about, but also the beginning to see that friendship or something like it existed in all these other species, especially in non-human primates like monkeys and apes, who are more like us. And once scientists did that, then they were able to measure what exactly was in these strong bonds that these other animals had and shared. And they found that, for instance, in these baboons in Africa, that the ones with the strong positive bonds lived longer and had more and healthier babies. And in evolutionary terms, you can't do better than that, longevity and reproductive success. So that's kind of what everybody's after. And then they were able, because in baboons, it's a little simpler. You can strip out the complex variables that you get with human lives. And what they were able to do was define a quality positive bond, or the definition of quality in friendship, as needing three things. It has to be stable and long-lasting, it's positive, so it makes the individuals involved feel good, and it's cooperative. There's a reciprocity and a kind of helpfulness to it. And that turns out to apply to humans pretty well as well. And in fact, when an anthropologist went looking at friendship across all of the cultures of the world, he found that the universals were very similar. The themes were similar, that that the things that were most common were that friendship was reported as making you feel good, so it was positive, and that it involved being helpful, especially in times of need. And so there's, you know, similar themes. And so I think when all the other things we talk about with friendship, like, so a lot of people will tell you that friendship is about loyalty or trust, or those things are there, but that comes in the positive and the cooperative parts of that definition. So that is my quality friendship definition. It needs to be long-lasting, positive, and cooperative. And you need all three so that, you know, it long-lasting, you can like someone from the minute you meet them, but to really become deep friends, you need time. And so if we can look at all of our relationships through that lens and kind of make it a template for all relationships, actually. Not just our friends.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great definition. Who wouldn't want those three things?
Well, exactly. And it translates into how we can be better friends too. What does it mean to be a good friend? I think it means being a steady, reliable presence in someone's life. That's the stable part. It means making them feel good, the positive part. And it means showing up and being helpful and reciprocating so that the relationship's not too lopsided. And so it's especially as we're coming out of this pandemic and, you know, our whole social lives have been shaken up, I think it's a good moment for a little refresh and for thinking, not just about what your friends give to you, but what you give to them and whether you are in fact delivering quality on your end.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, some people seem to have a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. We're talking about quantity now. Right. Others have only a few. And then, of course, there are some that are isolated. I was fascinated to see that animal researchers have found the same continuum among monkeys. Talk about those differences and their implications.
Yes. So there's a range of normal, I guess you could say. And that exists in, you know, so some monkeys are, friends with a whole lot of people. So actually what researchers are doing both in humans and in other species is doing social network analysis, where now the powerful computers we have allow you to chart and kind of map who's connected to who in what ways. And there are definitely different styles that we have. I think the easiest way to sum it up, though, is that there was a psychologist in the 90s working on this, and then people have updated it. But she developed the idea that there were three friendship styles in humans. And they're discerning. So that's one. And that's the most common, which is where you have just a handful of close friends. You prefer to spend time with a few people, but you have deep relationships with them. Independent people are more, consider themselves more self-sufficient, and they're relationships are more circumstantial. So they're friendly with people while they're working with them, but they don't necessarily work to maintain that relationship, for instance. And there are the fewest of that. And then the last category is acquisitive. and the more recent research breaks this down into two subsets. So you can be selectively acquisitive, and you can be unconditionally acquisitive. And basically, as it sounds, like acquisitive people are kind of adding friends as they go through life, and maintaining relationships and enjoy having a lot of friendships. The selective ones maybe are selective and unconditional. So unconditional is just you sort of gathering as many people around you as you can, right? And you tend to introduce your friends to each other. That's one of the interesting differences is, do you have separate relationships with people, or are you in one tight little group? Or do you know different people, but you work to connect them? And all of those things are possible, and all of it is it works. There's no one way to do friendship. That's what's interesting. But it does matter that you have this handful of very quality relationships at the core. You have to kind of start at the center and work out. And I don't know if everybody realizes that, like, it just isn't possible to have the same kind of relationship with everyone in your life, and you don't need to. Like, we don't have enough time. And literally, we don't have enough brain width or right. Brain bandwidth, I guess is what I want to say, to do that. And so a friend I had lunch with just the other day, she said that was one of the most striking things to her, was that she always felt this pressure to be equally good friends with this wide range of people. And reading my book made her realize that she didn't actually have to be, or that, you know, that wasn't necessarily expected. But so she would be someone who's acquisitive because she's got all these friends, right? And she's, but there are differences. There are sort of these concentric circles of our friends. There's the inner circle, and then the next one out is maybe 10 to 15 people, and then going on out like that. And that's okay. That's how it works. But anyway, I've gotten a little bit away from what your original question was, but it's, I think it's related. But so any of it is good, just not that really independent, self-sufficient thinking you don't need anybody. You're wrong. You're just wrong.
So that's even if you're not rejected, that is if you choose to be aloof or distant or independent. Both are equally bad for your health?
Well, no, both are not equally bad for your health. So if we're going to be specific, so there are differences. So loneliness, the difference between loneliness and social isolation is interesting. It's an objective versus a subjective situation. So social isolation that so many people around the world had to experience during the pandemic is an objective counting of the size of your social network and the number of social interactions that you have. Loneliness is the subjective sense that there's a mismatch between the amount of social connection you want and the amount you have. So if you are socially isolated, but you truly are not lonely, then you're better off. But unfortunately, even that objective social isolation, people who are socially isolated or who live alone do tend to die earlier than people who are not. But the loneliness is the worst thing for you, that feeling of dissatisfaction. But interestingly, loneliness is a little like stress. So a little bit of loneliness is actually good for you because it's a biological warning signal that your body needs to connect, that you need to connect. It looks deep in the brain, it looks like hunger pangs. It works like hunger and thirst to tell you to do something about it. The problem is when it becomes chronic, it starts to lead to all kinds of problems in your body. And just like stress does. So a little stress helps you, you know, deal in a crisis or do well on a test or giving a presentation or talking on a podcast. Right. But you know, a lot of stress, chronic stress is terrible for you. And loneliness is very similar. Chronic loneliness is terrible for you.
That's very interesting that it works that way, like a warning. Mm-hmm. And it's like pain, like physical pain. If you break your arm, it's good that it hurts because then you go see an orthopedist.
You don't get help. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But if you have chronic pain that is not serving as a warning, all sorts of terrible things happen. So, there are the close friendships and there are the other levels of friendship. It's quite an elastic term. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. The part you wrote about the immune system impact.
Yes.
The comparison, which I thought might be a researcher's leap, but it was still very powerful. The comparison between closeted gay men and HIV and monkeys with unstable social conditions. Explain that to us.
Well, this is so fascinating. This question of how loneliness might get into the immune system is really what we're talking about here. And it gives you some sense of how scientific ideas evolve. So this man named Steve Cole in Los Angeles was studying how genes are expressed in the body. And so, you know, we all start out in the world with a set of genes that kind of lay a template for who we're going to be, but whether those genes get expressed, to use the technical term, or basically whether they get turned on or off, depends a lot on experience and what happens to you in life. And Steve Cole thought that your social experience might be having an effect on whether your genes are expressed or not. And so in gay men with HIV/AIDS in the 90s, what people were finding was that closeted gay men were getting sicker and dying faster than men who were openly gay. And that had to be that the virus was replicating faster in those men. And why would that be? And so Steve Cole's theory was that being closeted had an effect on their social lives. It was a social stress, and that somehow that was changing the way their immune system worked. And he was talking about this research, and he ended up sort of crossing paths with a guy named John Cacioppo, who was a social psychologist at the University of Chicago, who was really the pioneer of this whole new science of loneliness. And Cacioppo was fascinated by
by Steve's work in gay men and this idea that the virus was replicating faster, which it was actually in the closeted gay men versus the openly gay men. And so what Cacioppo asked Cole to do was to, he said, as it happens, I have a whole bunch of blood samples from very lonely people and very socially content people, people with lots of friends. And he had these samples in his freezer. And so they did this little test run and they found basically the exact same thing was happening in the lonely people that was happening in the closeted gay men. I mean, not exact same, but we're talking about different things here. But what it came down to was that in the immune system, genes were expressed differently if you were lonely or if you were feeling this social stress. To jump forward a whole lot, what they figured out is that your gene expression changes in ways that make you more or less susceptible or resilient to viruses and to inflammation. And ultimately, Steve Cole called this, it's got a technical name, CTRA. It's the conserved transcriptional response to adversity. What it turns out is that our bodies do this in the face of all kinds of different adversities, and loneliness is just one of them. But why this really matters is because it really tells you that loneliness is right up there with other really awful things that people go through, like living through trauma and war, living through poverty, living through, it's not unique to loneliness, this particular response in the immune system, but it has to do with adversity and with difficult experiences. And so the same thing that was happening in the men with HIV was happening in the people who were very lonely and then has since been found in, children who lived through war and people who dealt with other kinds of extreme trauma. So that is the link between the men with HIV/AIDS and loneliness.
And it was found in monkeys.
And it was found in monkeys, right? Yes, sorry. Yeah. There was an additional line of research where they, at UC Davis, another Steve Capitano, there's a monkey version of HIV called simian immuno. I'm forgetting exactly. It was SIV. And in the monkeys, they were able, because when you're looking in animals, they're able to discover more of what's going on. They were able to see just exactly how the virus was replicating faster. What they did was, so monkeys, you can't exactly change the social lives of the monkeys in ways that mirror, mirror human differences, but what they could do was they could change what's truly socially stressful for monkeys is having to hang out with unfamiliar monkeys. And so they had different sets of animals who had more or less stable social environments. So some were put back in the same cage every day with the same monkeys, and others had their social lives changed up every day. In a way that induces real social stress in the monkeys. And the ones who lived in the unstable social environments had the same kinds of, they had faster replication of the virus in their bodies. And not only that, but it was spreading through the body in ways, I mean, it's pretty technical, but it was clear that the social environment was having this fundamental effect on the cells and on the gene expression in a way that nobody would have ever imagined was possible. I mean, how is it that a relationship that exists outside your body, could get in and change the way your cells respond to a virus? But it does.
And it apparently goes even further than just outside your body and inside. The research that showed that the influence of friends extends 3 degrees away, which means your friend's friends, somebody you don't even know, influences everything from your voting behavior to obesity and smoking. And what do you make of that?
Yes, that's true. There's, yes, so that is the work of Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler. And they have used that social network analysis that I mentioned earlier to map out the connections between large groups of people. And what they find is, yes, there is this knock-on effect to 3 degrees of separation, where you are much more likely to have all kinds of similarities with those people that are within the 3 degrees of separation. And then it kind of falls off. And that I talked earlier about the neuroscientists and looking at the way your brain processes the audio and visual world, auditory and visual world. And that also shows up basically to the same kind of 3 degrees of separation and then kind of falls apart, where you are more similar processing wise within those first 3 degrees and of connection and then not so much. And so it's very, it's fascinating. And, you know, we don't entirely get why, but what it tells us is, yes, that our friendships and our relationships are having this fundamental effect on our bodies in all kinds of ways. And yeah, they showed, I think Christakis and Fowler showed that it, you know, happiness is spread through this kind of chain, but so is sadness. And yes, your propensity to smoke or to quit smoking or to be obese, your political, some of that makes sense, right? You're more likely to talk about things like political choices with the people around you. But some of it is just really surprising. And so it just tells us about the power of the people in our lives.
And genes play a role in friendship too. Tell us about twin studies.
So twin studies are very, very important in genetics because they can give us a sense of how much how much of any particular trait or behavior is explained by heredity, by genetics, and how much is due to other things. And so they've been able to use twin studies and genetics to discover that there is some sort of basic sociability that your genes help determine, but it isn't, I'm forgetting the exact percentage, but it's not huge compared to other things, but it is, so environment makes a big difference, but it does mean that there's some sociability that is passed down through families. And also Christakis and Fowler found that we are, so your friends, you are actually more likely, you are more genetically similar to your friends than you would imagine. It's kind of like to the degree of fourth cousins. And they posit that maybe that means friends are sort of like functional kin. And this goes beyond, this is more than just the idea that, you know, we tend to have friends who look like us, who maybe are the same race or ethnicity, or and so obviously you might think that your genes are more likely to be similar, but it isn't. It's well beyond that. And so there is this similarity in our genes with our friends, and in the way we process the world, and in our level of sociability with our within our families and our, and so yes, it's down at this very, very, at the level of our DNA and our neurons, you know, friendship is at work.
Well, finally, let's talk a bit about culture that impacts friendship styles. You bring the example of Dutch social scientists who posed the passenger's dilemma question to a huge number, 30,000, I think it was, white collar workers in many, many, many different countries. So tell us, what is the passenger's dilemma and what did they find?
Yes. So I spoke at the beginning about the similarities in how people handle friendship, but this research revealed the differences, the cultural differences in different countries. And so the passenger's dilemma is a is a famous philosophical question of, basically sums up that you're the passenger in a car, your friend is driving and they're speeding and they hit someone. And then your friend asks them, you to lie and say that they weren't speeding. So would you lie for your friend to protect your friend, or would you tell the truth because you're, if you're determined to tell the truth, then it reflects a sort of interest in law and order and in, you know, government, or a belief in right and wrong in government. Well, not right and wrong, a belief in law and order. Let's leave it at that. And what they found is that there's a really enormous difference, actually, in different countries in terms of what percentage of people are going to lie for their friends and who are not. And so I think it was 7 in 10 in Venezuela would lie for their friends, versus in Switzerland and the US, it was 1 in 10. I may be getting the numbers not exactly right, but it's close to that. And we don't know why, but the thinking, or there's an overlay that you can do that an anthropologist did, where he discovered that in the countries where people were more likely to lie for their friends, there was less stability and less economic security. And so it kind of makes sense that you actually need your friends more than you need, like, you know, law and order, the rule of law in some places, that, you know, who are you going to rely on when you're in trouble? Is it the state or is it your friend? And in countries where there was more economic security, more political stability, people were less likely to lie for their friends. So, you know, this we don't know for sure what explains it, but the difference is clearly there. And there is this really fascinating difference then in the corresponding levels of political stability and security.
Lydia, I've enjoyed talking with you about one of my favorite subjects, friends and friendships. Before I let you go, can you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. I am co-writing a book with a woman, Dr. Dana Susskind at the University of Chicago, and it is all about the importance of early brain development and how society needs to help make that work better for parents and caregivers. And the pandemic has only made it clearer how, at least here in the United States, childcare fell apart. And so it's not just about childcare. It's about brain development, which is a subject near and dear to my heart, almost as much as friendship.
Yeah. Well, I wish you lots of good luck with the new project. Thank you so much for being on the show today. And thanks for your very important work on a vital subject that turns out to be even more vital than we thought.
Thank you, Renee.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.